After the Alaska Gold Rush, one of the nation's richest men brought a boatload of scientists and artists to the state and portrayed it for the rest of the country. And the picture stuck. Good morning and welcome to Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Where did Harriman get that idea? He got it the same place Lewis and Clark did. From Alexander Humboldt, the first ecologist. Our number, 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at APRN.org. More about Humboldt on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Every once in a while, I get to do a program that is just pure brain candy. Just a program that goes off into the intellectual stratosphere. And I'm hoping today is one of those because we have a real scholar among us, and she's from Alaska. Her name is Dr. Laura Dasso-Walls. She's a professor at the University of South Carolina, but will be soon be moving to Notre Dame. And she was born in Ketchikan. And raised mostly, I guess, in the Seattle area. And I want to welcome you to the show, Laura.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, it's a great pleasure to have you here. I'm going to go through your accomplishments here for a moment and your honors to give people some idea of why I've asked you to be on the program. You have written a book, and it's about the little-known Alexander von Humboldt. Now, when you say that name, people immediately think about some place that they might think of the Humboldt Current. They might think of, let's say Humboldt County. That's an interesting area.
Right.
There are all sorts of things named after Humboldt really all over the world. And yet, who was Humboldt? Well, to start with, there were two of them. But the Humboldt we're talking about is Alexander von Humboldt. And he is a shining figure of the Enlightenment and maybe into the post-Enlightenment. So here is this book, The Passage to Cosmos, Alexander von Humboldt and the Shaping of America by Laura Dasso-Walls. And this book has now won the Merle Curti Award from the Organization of American Historians for the best book in American intellectual history, the Michelle Kendrick Memorial Book Award for the Best Book in Literature and Science from the Society for Literature, Science, and the Arts, and now the James Russell Lowell Prize from the Modern Language Association, which is one of your basic literature prizes.
Right,
so,
right.
So you're crossing all the disciplines here, and that's kind of what Humboldt did too, isn't it?
Well, that's exactly right, and I think that's what drew me to him. I've always been interested in science and literature together, and that led me to Thoreau, and then I was trying to find Henry David Thoreau's sources, and that led me to Humboldt, and I had not particularly heard of him myself. This was back when I was in grad school, and I got curious, so I had a professor who gave us a little bit of his writing, and I started to read it, and I said, this is incredible stuff. I love this. This sounds just like Thoreau. And so I started reading lots of Humboldt, and I couldn't leave it alone. So I finally got to the point where I just had to write the book. And so here we are.
Here we are a whole lot of research later.
Yeah, well, we're talking, 20 years from one end of that, or more, from one end of that picture to the other. So sometimes these things, do take time. But going back to Humboldt, I mean, first of all, he embraced so much that it's hard to keep up with him, and I don't think any single human being could, and people knew that even in his own day, that he was somebody whose intellect was what? I mean, he puts Renaissance men in the shade, perhaps, but also that to recover that, and it stretches your own brain when you talk about brain candy at the top of the show. It's really been fun to feel your own brain and heart being stretched open enough to begin to understand this. So I don't feel like I'm an expert, put it that way. There's a whole lot more to learn. It's really very interesting to see the way his mind works and how he brings literature and all the sciences, social justice issues, politics, economics. It's all one big picture to him. He called it cosmos.
Yeah. And he was quite the geographer. I mean, I think we have to say that. This is a man who was very picky about his maps, a man who would measure the barometric pressure, the color of the sky, the elevation,
yes.
And was busy correcting maps.
Yes. The one thing, if you are in a variety of specialties, you'll go back and you'll find Humboldt as somewhere in the founding. But the one field that is pretty much credited to him would be physical geography. He's certainly one of the founders of the science of physical geography. And, I mean, he was more than that, but that certainly becomes what he's known for because of his innovations with, well, first of all, he explored South America from 1799 to 1804. He lived in there. He lived for a year in Mexico. And topped it off with a visit to the United States. He stopped off because he wanted to meet Thomas Jefferson, felt that that was an obligation. He was a Republican himself and wanted to see the new United States and meet his hero, Jefferson. So what he was doing in that 5 years was in part mapping and measuring and exploring, collecting specimens of all kinds. He was with one other person, Aimé Bonpland, so it was just the two of them. And he financed all this himself, so he had no government financing. He wanted to be free of all entanglements. And it really was a revolutionary trip.
I want to step back because we're definitely going to go back to the exploration, but I want to step back just
sure.
a little bit for the context of how it could be that this German researcher, this German groundbreaker, in really even at the core of the Enlightenment, ends up being almost totally forgotten, and you know I don't think you have to look too far to see you know hostilities between the Anglo and particularly American culture and the German culture. The difficulty of the German language,
mm-hmm.
and the appropriation, really, I think, of a lot of a German intellectual heritage in this country. So we see that Emerson glommed onto to a bunch of Humboldt's thinking, Thoreau, as you've already mentioned, Edgar Allan Poe,
right,
and so. Basically, we have a humble heritage without the Humboldt.
Well, that's it, and that's what got my attention because this is not true in much of the rest of the world. I mean, he's a folk hero in Latin America because he was associated one of Humboldt's follower is too strong a word, but Bolivar was somebody who knew Humboldt, and Humboldt encouraged him to. Become a revolutionary. So Humboldt is seen as a kind of liberating hero, kind of a combination of George Washington and Lewis and Clark, if you can imagine them all being rolled together. So why would he be forgotten in the United States when he saw the United States as the hope of the future of the world? And that's why he wanted to meet Thomas Jefferson. So he was very important, and that's why the book's subtitle, The Shaping of America, I kept uncovering all of these connections between Humboldt and people he was writing. I mean, he wasn't just passively behind the scenes. He was actively pushing and prodding people of all sorts, explorers and scientists, but also statesmen and artists and writers, to get involved. And he had tasks, go out and study this, go find out more about that. You should be passing legislation to abolish slavery and so on and so forth. And so he was very active in correspondence and in discussions with people, plus his publications. He was one of the best-selling writers of his day, and his books were immediately translated into English, and they sold very well in the United States among educated readers. Americans, if you went to Berlin, you had to visit Humboldt, and he welcomed all Americans to his doorstep. So how did he lose out in the kind of fight for reputation? I think you hit part of it, is that sense of, you know, kind of hostility to German culture, which is, well, this kind of radical thinking that Humboldt brought with him, and some of the what associated, for instance, with socialism and kind of a what foreign ideas. Later part of the 19th century, and of course World War I and World War II made it very difficult to look back at German heritage. But the other thing that is really interesting is those people we do celebrate as heroes and remember, scientific heroes like Charles Darwin, tended to have people who sort of pinned his name to the theories. So it's Darwin's theory of evolution. But there isn't a Humboldt theory of anything. His name is, in a way, his work's everywhere. He was one of the founders of modern science. But his name isn't labeling anything, so it gets appropriated by other people, and it just kind of, people take it away into their own place.
Wow, and Darwin was enormously inspired by Humboldt.
He was, yeah. Darwin went to South America because he had read Humboldt's personal narrative of Humboldt's own trip to South America, and the young Darwin said, that's what I want to do. And so he pulled all the strings he could until he got invited to go on the Beagle to South America. As soon as he got there, he took a look around and said, everything I see reminds me of Humboldt. I'm fit only to read Humboldt right now. So that was his first stepping off point, and indeed his entire career is cast in Humboldtian terms.
So we have the Spanish basically come ripping into the New World in their inimitable form in the 1500s.
And, right.
And it's brutal, and it's well documented how brutal it was. It was genocidal and so forth. By the time Humboldt arrives, we have a situation where the Spanish are still there, but it is a different place now. The post. It's 100, more than 100 years after all this, and the people that are there now are the colonials. They're enlightened themselves. They're genteel. They're urbane. They get along great with this German scholar. And he's like the only scholar allowed in. So he has a monopoly on exploring South America, basically.
Well, pretty much. He was good at sweet-talking people, and he sweet-talked his way into the graces of the King of Spain.
And he had a big, fat purse. That didn't hurt.
And he had it, yeah. And he said, look, all you have to do is give me permission. I'll finance it. I mean, he had the monopoly, and he was able to travel under with a passport. People cooperated. He seems to have been somebody, again, who could talk to just about anybody about anything, which made it easy for him to get around. And but he had the ethic that scientific knowledge needed to be free. It needed to spread among all peoples. So he would find things in the records that had been kept in archives without public view, and took notes, and as soon as he got back out to Europe, published everything openly.
Wow. Yeah.
Which, including, one of the things he wanted to talk to Thomas Jefferson about was Mexico, which
right.
very, very little was known.
Yeah, I want to hold you up on that geography for
sure.
A moment, because I want to go back to the intellectual history and
sure.
why his travels in Latin America turned into such a huge bestseller. And part of it, I think, was because you look at, you know, even Shakespeare, but certainly like Raleigh and Columbus and a number of other explorers came back and just promoted the hell out of the wonders of the New World and what a promised land it was over there and all this. And then you get a whole other view of it. I mean, inside the New World by Alexander von Humboldt. I mean, it was like a thunderclap.
Well, he was, yeah, he was in places, not the coast, where most Europeans who had written had just skimmed up the coasts. And he went inland and deep inland. And so when he started to publish his adventures, he was telling all sorts of amazing and hair-raising tales, always from the perspective of science. But, you know, this is kind of, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. And it was wonderful. It was romantic. It was eye-opening. It captured people's imaginations. He had a way of writing that was very descriptive and beautiful that... And then he never finished this narrative, too, so he kind of leaves you on this cliffhanger. And Darwin had this all with him. He read it on the journey across the Atlantic. When he gets to the American side, he posts a message back to his family to please, please, please send him the next volume. He can't, you know, what happens next? And there wasn't any next volume. Humboldt just, you know, went on to other things and leaves us dangling. So this was, this was exciting stuff, and captured the imagination and fired all sorts of people up to come to the New World themselves. And things got difficult in in Mexico and South America, because this was the time of revolution, Bolivarian revolutions and the Mexican Revolution. So a lot of them went to the United States, or started in the United States and then went west into the Western territories that, of course, were disputed. They weren't America yet. They were, they belonged to various Native American peoples, or they were Spanish, or the French were involved, the British. So you
and
go
even,
up the
even the Russians.
Coast, Russian.
Even the Russians.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, this was...
There's
this
a point.
Was,
there's a point where the Russians get all the way to California, going after sea otters.
Well, and you can imagine how nervous this made the Spanish, because that was the territory that they claimed. So what happened, and this is how, I mean, here I am in a library reading Humboldt, thinking I'm reading about Mexico, and he starts talking about the Mexican, the Spanish expeditions up the Pacific coast, and the Spanish get very nervous about the Russians and about the British coming down the Pacific coast, and so they start sending expeditions up in the particularly what the 17 especially the 1780s and the 1790s. And Humboldt, of course, his own journey was you know, began in 1799, so this is real recent history as far as he was concerned. So he's writing all this up, all this secret stuff up, and he's writing it for publication. And he's fascinating on these Spanish journeys, and this is where I find myself reading about Alaska. You mentioned that I was born in Ketchikan, and so I'm tracing Humboldt. I have to read this one little section of something, because I was trying to work this out. To write about Mexico for Humboldt meant including the Spanish settlements and expeditions up the Pacific coast through the Strait of Juan de Fuca, Los Islas de San Juan y La Chanel del Rosario, all the way up through the Queen Charlotte's to Revillagigedo Island, past Baranoff and Chichagof and Kuprianov Islands to the towns of Cordova and Valdez. You're hearing all the Spanish names?
Yeah.
In fact, it was through Humboldt I realized that my being born in Ketchikan, Alaska, meant that I was from a Tlingit fishing village on Revillagigedo Island, surveyed by the Spanish in their rivalry with the British, who were trying to keep out the French, in a landscape claimed by Russia that just after the American Civil War would be sold to the United States. If that doesn't make your head spin, I don't know what does. And that, I think, is why Humboldt was dying to go to Alaska. I mean, this just, he wanted to go there more than anything else. And he thought he was going to. He writes Thomas Jefferson, and he writes other people that, hey, you know, as soon as I finish writing up my South American travel materials, I'm going to follow Lewis and Clark out to the mouth of the Columbia, and I'm going to go north, and I'm going to go see this land for myself. And the shame of it is, you know, he thought he had maybe about a five-year task to write up his adventures and write up all the science that had come out of that scientific results. It took him 30 years. And by the time he was done, you know, he was famous and he was older and, you know, too old to do the Lewis and Clark thing. So we have a what if.
We have a fabulous what if.
Yeah, we sure do. That really. But there it is. He's fascinated by this part of the world because he sees this as the kind of natural landscape, but also a cultural landscape where all of these currents are meeting. And he himself was fascinated by. I mean, he was a scientist who was known for as a natural scientist, but he took more notes on native peoples than on any other single subject, and he's constantly reporting conversations, and he was interested in political history and economic history. So I think he saw this as a kind of laboratory and would have wanted to document all of this confusion of peoples and get a sense of what the future held for it.
You know, this is absolutely fascinating. We're speaking with Laura Dasso Walls. She is a professor of English at the University of South Carolina. She's written a book combining science and history and art, I would have to say.
Yes, they're smart in there.
Yeah, The Passage to Cosmos, Alexander von Humboldt and the Shaping of America. And Laura was born in Ketchikan. Her dad worked for, the Fish and Wildlife Service and Fish and Game both, fishing.
The National Marine Fisheries Service. I grew up hearing about the Ketchikan Lab.
Uh-huh. And maybe more people would know, if they don't know of John Dasso, they might know of Ethel, who was the editor of the Ketchikan to Barrow column for Alaska Sportsman between 1942 and 63.
Oh, yes. Yeah, she was. She followed Dad up to Ketchikan. This was just the beginning of World War II, and she was in despair because she was majoring in English and thought she was leaving behind her career in writing, which is what she wanted to do. And she walked into Ketchikan at the point when Emery Tobin was getting the Alaska Sportsman magazine underway, and didn't take long for her to... he handed her some copy and said, see if you can proofread this. She found two typos that everybody else in the office had missed, and Emery said, you're hired. And she worked for Emery, and then when Bob Henning bought the firm, she worked for Bob Henning. And she came back and worked for Bob Henning again through the years when it was the Alaska Northwest Publishing Company. So she was one of the voices of Alaska herself for a long, long time.
Wow, yeah. And then also I think we should mention that you feel really close with your godparents, John and Polly Dyers, who are probably well-known to a lot of Alaskans.
Yes, right. They got to know my parents up in Ketchikan, and then, you know, as the families both wound up down in the Seattle area, which is where I grew up, they kept on being very close friends. Some people may also know Bob and Dixie Boddy, who are also part of that circle. And were up in, I remember visiting them in Ketchikan when I was very young. That's where I first learned to fish. Then further up in Petersburg when we were all a little bit older.
Well,
so those are good memories going back for a few years there. But, yeah, I grew up on stories of Alaska.
Well, I sure hope we can scam up some way of getting you back up to Alaska. I think you would probably accept the invitation.
I would, yeah, yeah. I went up there myself to Juneau for a while, where I had, you know, another side of the family was up there for a while. And it was a great adventure, but I got there at a time when people were getting laid off. Alaska's, I think, maybe still kind of a boom or bust economy, and I hit it on the downside. So I ended up going back to Seattle, and of course life took over, and then on to doing other things. But
You've got quite the other thing going now at Notre Dame, where you're about to become the William P. and Hazel White Hazel B. White, chair of the English.
Chair of
English at the University of Notre Dame, and you're going to be working with the History and Philosophy of Science Department and actually designing a course of education that will let students study both science and literature.
Well, that's the goal. And
I'm loving this.
See. Yeah. Well, this is going back, you know, again, why are we drawn where we're drawn? I was drawn to Thoreau because I myself started out life planning to be a scientist, and I had this moment of reckoning when I was assisting in a laboratory where I realized that I didn't want to be a scientist. I wanted somehow to find a way to think about science, but I loved to write, and how could I combine science with literature, which was my other love, and of course art.
I want to put you back there, but I know you have that part that you wrote about the bird and all that, but
yeah,
it's gonna.
Yeah.
I think we need to take the break first. So
sure.
I want to do. So okay. I want to do a little history sketch with Humboldt meeting Thomas Jefferson, and Jefferson basically obtaining from Humboldt a bunch of intelligence about the what you'd have to call the Mexican Empire at that time. You know, the whole California, New Mexico, all that in there, that was all part of Mexico at the time.
That was Mexico, and Humboldt didn't realize that in a few not that many decades, the U.S. would be going to Mexico and fighting a war over acquiring that very territory.
Yeah, but what has happened is that the Louisiana Purchase has happened.
Right.
And Humboldt and Jefferson, I mean, they actually spent some time visiting together and then continuing in correspondence and so forth. And it's pretty persuasive, really, that Jefferson based his orders to Lewis and Clark in exploring that territory on the kind of exploration that Humboldt had already done in Latin America.
Well, the reports from Humboldt had already come north, but Lewis and Clark had actually already embarked by the time Humboldt and Jefferson were sitting down together. And, of course, why were they sitting down together? Jefferson had this, again, wide-ranging mind and very enlightenment sense of you know, you look at the whole wide range. But Humboldt was able to give Jefferson and later generations a set of what we would recognize sort of modern scientific tools. In other words, how do you take all this information and kind of convert it into form that's useful scientific results, not just a good narrative? And a lot of that became very useful for later scientific expeditions. The Army Corps of Engineers that founded the topographical expeditions to exploring expeditions to the west.
Oh yeah, and all the way up into Alaska. You know,
all the way up into Alaska.
Same
one
deal.
One of the classic ones was the Wilkes expedition from 1838 to 42, that went up the coast and tried to establish. The notion had been that the great port for the northwest coast would be on the Columbia River, and the Wilkes expedition lost one of their ships. Going into that, into the mouth of the Columbia.
Whoops, not such a good idea.
Terrible place to put a port.
Bad currents, bad.
Bad place.
Sandbars.
So they moved on up the coast and decided and proved that Puget Sound was much more appropriate for the major port city that eventually became Seattle, and then went further up the coast from there. So you have. What this sense of what the United States trying to locate and ground itself into that far northwest, and using Humboldt's methods to make this a reality, how to make all this practical and how to get scientific results out of it that would impress the world,
and it was successful. I mean,
it was, yeah.
When you look at it, this was a you know, actually gathering intelligence about the terrain, the weather, the indigenous peoples, everything under the sun, provided a more robust feeling of terra incognita. It wasn't so incognita anymore, and this provided a more solid base for real supply lines and trails and so forth to be opened up, as opposed to the Russian method, which was essentially running along the coast and you know, grabbing every fur you could and sending them back, and it petered out. You know, all the other empires, all the other empires petered out except for this one.
Well, and this one, and this is built on, you know, first of all, you need absolutely accurate maps. You absolutely have to measure every point with precision so that you've got good, reliable maps, because especially coastlines, you have to know precisely where those shoals are or where that coast is. And then you want to understand what we call it physical geography, but of course it's everything that's tied in, plants and animals. You want to measure your elevation so that, because how high you are is going to influence what can grow, what the ecology is like, and what the limiting factors are for it. So Humboldt is going around kind of like he's trying to do GIS systems before we have GIS. He's trying to measure precisely where he is in order to create a holistic picture of the landscape and all the elements that compose it. I devised a mnemonic for myself. I called it explore, collect, measure, connect. And if you're doing all four of those things, you're likely to be acting as a Humboldtian. You've got to go explore yourself. This is not armchair work. You've got to collect information and material things, objects, plants, animals. Many people was collecting ethnographic specimens, information. You've got to talk to people, write down what they say, measure everything, you know, temperatures, elevation, mapping coordinates, and so on. And connect. The fourth one is the most important. These are not disconnected facts. The real intellectual work is then sitting back and saying, how does all this hang together? And so the more specific you are, the more global, the more planetary you can become. That was Humboldt's method.
Laura Walls, I want to thank you so much for being with us on this program. We spent the first half hour of the show exploring really the past, and I want to zip into the future for the next part, because there's a reason why you wanted to write this book, besides the fact that you got fascinated with Thoreau and realized how much of it went back to Humboldt. And we'll go into that as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com. One answer to our state's declining oil production, Port McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska Susitna Borough.
What in the world kind of relevance can a guy that died in, 1849 or so?
1859, before Origin of Species came out.
Our own times. That's what we're exploring here with Laura Dassel-Walls, the author of The Passage to Cosmos, a multiple award-winning book about Alexander von Humboldt. And we've been busy rewriting history for the last half hour, and I want to move into the future now, because that's where we're all going, especially here in Alaska. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If calling from Anchorage, it's 550-8422. Email us talk@aprn.org. And don't be bashful. Chime right in. Maybe you knew maybe you knew the family or the people that they're connected with. You read that Ketchikan to Barrow column in Alaska Sportsman for all those years, and you'd like to have a word with Laura, just call right up. We're open for business here on the show. But I want to take you to the moment when you changed your career, which you write so eloquently about, and people resonate with this, I think, with this type of experience, because I think every one of us, it's strange. Sometimes the things that for some reason change your life or stick in you have no real apparent spectacular there's nothing mm-hmm. really special about them, except that they just were the right thing at the right time and they somehow said it. So
yeah,
say it.
Okay, well, shall I?
Yes.
I could read this, just a few sentences here. I had thought so a lot about this moment and trying to put it into language. So this is, I was at the Burke Museum at the University of Washington, and I had been working with a scientist because I was eager to get started. I was still a freshman there. And he was working with birds, and I was learning how to stuff birds, and various things would come in, and I was really into this. And then the way I wrote about it is this, but one day something different came in. It was a ruby-crowned kinglet. I'd seen them in the wild, quick, drab puffs of greenish-gray, but I'd never held one in my hand before. He was freshly dead, tiny, a mere tuft of down, and beautiful, so beautiful I was shocked to tears, softly shaded olive browns, elegant to the last detail, topped with that brilliant jewel-bright ruby crown. Every feather was an astonishment. I held that kinglet in my hand, bewildered, and something inside me broke. I understood my professor's need for data points, but what I beheld asked another and very different question. I didn't know then just what it was or how to begin to search for an answer, but I did know that my path had changed. I worked a bit longer at the museum. After an agonized review of the university catalog, I changed my major to English. I had never taken an English course, but I loved to read and write. And so on it goes. And that moment of standing there at the laboratory bench looking at this tiny little bird, and something about that, like I say, I was called, I was being asked a question, and I'm still trying to figure out the answer. And I think the question is something like, how can such things be? And of course, that's a deep question, so no wonder it's taking me a lifetime to work on it.
Well, you've certainly persisted.
Well, yes, and I think the immediate question, of course, is I've been writing recently about truth and beauty, and I think scientific truth is one dimension of the human quest, and another is the creation of beauty. And I was poised where I was, I was seeking truth or in an enterprise that was seeking truth, but I also was arrested by the sheer beauty of this one single tiny little bird, and that's the collision that precipitated this kind of crisis for me. And the result is that I am still trying to work out the relationship between well, we code it as the humanities and the sciences. You know, the humanities are the place where we study and create objects of beauty, beautiful prose, beautiful poems, beautiful pictures. And in the sciences, of course, we seek truth, the truth of nature, and we try not to think so much about beauty, subjective qualities in science. And yet, to me, where are you if you think of the two happening together? Well, it was Humboldt. Thoreau is where I immediately went, because I thought, you know, he understands this, and his writing was one way in. Thoreau himself was very interested in science, and that was the aspect of his career that I tried to explore some more. But then you turn to one of Thoreau's sources on this, Alexander von Humboldt, and here you have somebody who's a scientist, not a literary writer. So it's like approaching from two sides, the literary writer Thoreau, who's interested in science, and then you've got the scientist Humboldt, who is trying to write beautiful prose and is fascinated by artists and was himself quite an accomplished artist. And how can you bring these two together, and how can we bring them together today? I mean, when I posed this Kinglet moment, I had, at that point, I felt that I had to choose. I could be a scientist, or I could move over into the humanities. I didn't know any way to do the same, to do those together. And that is, I think, typical or true for many of us who have a kind of mindset that we want to connect these things, and yet we feel that we have to do one or the other. And it's the division that C.P. Snow famously wrote about back in the 50s, the two cultures. And he says, he's a physicist, and he says, how is it that the scientists and the poets can't talk to each other? This is a terrible state of affairs. And the future of humanity really depends on getting these two cultures to communicate.
Well, I have I like to have explorers on the program. And one set of explorers that I had on were from Seldovia. We had them on just about a month ago. And they do what they do, they call ground truth trekking. And they're all into GIS and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And fixated on Latoya Bay, by the way. You probably know about that place. That's where all that's where La Perouse came a cropper.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it just these incredibly violent title episodes that take place there and so forth. They feel that by, as you were saying at Humboldt, you have to get out there. You actually have to be there. And this is very important to them, that they actually go to the place, they actually experience it, you know, with the physicality of their own bodies.
Yes, right.
In order to explore it. And yet there's something so creative about this. And then I think about when I was a kid, I used to love science fiction and those illustrations that Chesley Bonestell used to do of the what it looked like if you were on the surface of other planets, you know, on Mars and so forth, and they were very beautiful. They're still very beautiful paintings, but they're totally paled by the actualities of these places. As we have gotten our eyes out into the universe, it's only gotten more beautiful and more wonderful throughout. It always is more beautiful than anything we could possibly picture, every time. And
this is what
Humboldt would have been totally expecting.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, his big blockbuster work that he published, he was still working on it when he died, was called Cosmos. And there may be a few people out there who remember Carl Sagan's TV series, Cosmos, and the two were brothers under the skin. Humboldt's Cosmos takes the reader, and he says this, I'm going to take you on a journey. And he takes us on this journey out to the stars, as far as the strongest telescope could reach, in the 1840s. And he imagines what it would look like and what we would see, and he describes all these stellar objects and beings. And, of course, one thinks about the Hubble telescope and what we can see today. And this would have been, this was Humboldt's idea of heaven in a way. Think of being able to see this beauty. So he tries to get the reader to imagine it, but then he brings us closer and closer to Earth. And this is a view of Earth that, of course, anticipates the view we all know today from starting with the Apollo moonshot, when the astronauts took the first photograph of Earth seen from the moon. And this was a very Humboldtian moment, because Humboldt tries to imagine what would the Earth look like from outer space, and he tries to describe it as a planet and describe the beauty of this extraordinary planet on which there is life and on which there are people. So he brings us all the way out and then brings us all the way into Earth. And then in the second volume of this book, Cosmos, he says, now we have to understand the human mind, because we see all of this in my first volume through the imagination, right? We aren't actually out in space, so we have to imagine ourselves. So how can we understand the human mind that allows us to imagine such things? And so he takes us into a history of the concept of nature and the history of exploration and the history of the what he thinks of as the growth and development of the human mind, which happens in relationship to nature. It's like nature is what calls out our capacities, our potentials, and helps us become what helps enlarge our mind. And in turn, we then turn to nature and enhance. We are the ones who see beauty. So the cosmos, in Humboldt's concept, is the physical universe itself, apart from human beings, but it becomes a cosmos through our imagination. That is, we look into the physical universe and see it as a whole, see it as beautiful, and see it as ordered. And that's what we bring to the cosmos.
I think you're getting around to environmentalism somehow.
It does. Humboldt, in his work, he is one of the people who founds the science of ecology. It isn't called ecology, and for some decades, but that sense of the interrelationships between human beings and the environment that we live in, and that we in turn influence or create. So this in some ways is very particular. You speak of environmentalism. Humboldt is noticing things that he's seeing colonial era destruction. One of the cases that people asked him about was Lake Valencia in Venezuela. They said, why is the land around this area drying up, and why is the lake level dropping? And Humboldt went to work on this scientific problem and realized that it was deforestation. And he traces the causes. When deforestation causes the land is not absorbing the moisture so that it goes down to the water table and keeps the lake high, it's running off instead. He documents all this, and he's becomes one of the very first people to document how human beings' use of the land can actually degrade the ecosystem. This was a very novel idea. The notion that humans could change nature was an extraordinary stretch.
Boy,
and
we
it
ever
took decades
yeah.
for this and to we, take hold.
Yeah.
But there it is. There's the beginning. Yeah. So it comes out of a scientific observation.
Okay. We don't have much time left, and I got to take a break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, providing insight on statewide business and government issues. There's more information online at akbizmag.com.
We're talking about Alexander von Humboldt, and he was the first physical geographer, and what lessons he might hold for us today. And we're talking with Laura Dasso-Walls, author of The Passage to Cosmos. We've gotten on to Humboldt's notion of cosmos, which is completed by our attention, by what we are able to see in it. And a pretty interesting, you know, Poe tried to interpret this for the American audience, and also Emerson, and they couldn't mm-hmm. avoid putting God in there. But somehow, for Humboldt, God was almost beside the point of it.
Well, that caused a lot of controversy in the U.S., and some of the translations into English just kind of, they, you know,
they went ahead and put God in.
Went ahead and put God in, and which, well, Humboldt was, I don't think, in any sense irreligious, but he was somebody who was thought in terms of comparative religions, many different religious traditions. And so any particular tradition seemed to him to be culturally driven, and he was trying to think universally. So
he probably got along real well with Jefferson, who's thought of as being a theist.
Yeah. Well, there you are. There's that Enlightenment perspective,
right.
You know, it's not that there is no God or that God isn't part of the universe, but you can't say that. It's partly in terms of the origin of science. It's that. Says you cannot say that God created it this way and that that's a scientific explanation. You have to remove God as an explanatory figure and try to understand it naturalistically. So Humboldt does that, tries to understand how the world works naturalistically.
Well, the grief that he got was nothing compared to what Darwin got.
Well, that's, you know, when you start talking about humanity apart, you know, as naturalistic, that did get very charged. And, you know, again, Humboldt didn't live long enough to see that. But
right.
But it's clear that, I think his writing Cosmos in his old age is... It's not in any sense a synonym for God, but I think many of us today would resonate with that sense that it may not be in a particular Judeo-Christian tradition. It may comprehend many traditions, religious traditions, but that there's something that's very hard to name. That again, why should such things be that they are at all? That there is a cosmos at all seems ultimately mysterious in a way that provokes awe. It's the most beautiful concept that Humboldt could imagine. And in terms of the quest for beauty, you think about, the sense that beauty is something that makes us long to... replicate it, to respond to it, to do. You can't just see something beautiful. You have to do something about it. You have to somehow contribute to it, or so you want to write a poem or paint a picture or, you know, devise a scientific theory or somehow, you know, contribute to it and pass it along. And I think that's what's driving Humboldt, is this is beauty to him, and he can't just rest with it. He has to communicate it and try to create a world in which other people, whether it's through writing or artwork, beautiful pictures, or public education, museums, universities, schools, that all people could be drawn into this kind of cycle of taking enjoyment in the world and then out of enjoyment wanting to know more about it, and the more you know, then the more exciting and the more beautiful it becomes to you. So this was a kind of a cycle that he thought his own work would start.
Well, you know, Laura, I think your service has been that you're willing to let your heart go into it, and I think that's that's tough. Maybe a little easier from a literature point of view than from a science point of view, but still, it's tough to kind of put it out there like that. And I appreciate you doing that. I want to throw this in: at the American Association for the Advancement of Science this past February, their theme was science across borders, across boundaries, mm-hmm. and so they tried to look at interdisciplinary things, and. You know, they have a long way to go. I guess that's what I have to say.
Hard work.
I went to a session on I went to a session on invasive species, and and it was very interesting to see that when you actually start looking at the biology of it, and you always say, "Well, what are we going to do about it?" Right? Well, most of them will kill themselves off over time or exhaust their habitat and things like that. You know, it's just a question of how long. But What they discover, for instance, is that there will be a pest, and there will be a kind of tree that has this pest, and the tree and all the trees in a part of a mosaic will all develop an immunity to that particular pest, but it only happens in a patch. And so it is this patchiness that we're unable to, maybe GIS will give us a way to see this patchiness and start getting our heads around it, because apparently that's where we are. Terry Tempest Williams called it some time ago a mosaic, and I think that's what we've got. We have a mosaic.
And I think the mosaic quality is something Humboldt saw as he went, you know, around the world, really, place to place, and he tried to understand, why is everything different? Why do I see this mosaic quality? And what accounts for it, but then what connects it? And that's, I think, again, if I think about, you know, my situation, am I going to be a biologist or am I going to be an English major? That sense that, you know, we need biologists and we need English majors, and they're very different. And the disciplines, it's okay to have. You need specialists to really drill down and really grasp hold of something. But we also need to find ways to step outside of the specialties and start connecting and start talking to each other. And, you know, I think we're at a moment right now when a lot of people are realizing this, and we're working out ways. We're starting to make this something we know we need to do in the 21st century to start hooking things up and talking more across the disciplines and across the specialists.
I think we gotta let the artists in. We gotta let the people
have trained
their intuitions, to try and come to grips with this and to acquire some literacy in some of these scientific fields.
Well, and I think part of Humboldt, I mentioned that he was a beautiful writer. He wanted to make people care about this. And so, yes, he could be very dry and technical if he was just, you know, commuting information to his fellow specialists. But when he's writing for the broad population, he wants to write in a way that they will use their imaginations to see these beautiful tropical landscapes that Humboldt loved so much, but also their emotions to feel them, to feel some of that passion and love that Humboldt himself felt, and that then people would care about it, and then they would want to know more. So that's how he integrates them. And that sense of the scientific writer who can communicate passion and the beauty of the field, there are many of these writers out there. But I also want the literary people to read science.
All right. Laura Dessau-Walls, has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Steve. It has been a pleasure.
And good luck to you in your job out in Notre Dame. Maybe we'll get back in touch with some artists and do it all over again.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you. Thanks to Josh Edge for answering the phones. He didn't have too much to do. Dave Waldron on the controls. Next week, going local about climate warming with Majora Carter. Oh, boy, from the South Bronx. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.